Okay, this is tape number 7, review of communications, United States Coast Guard cutter Itasca, the Amelia Earhart case, June-July 1937. We're working with Captain W.L. Sutter, who was communications officer on the Itasca at the time, and we are using his, what we call tape number 4, and we are in the middle of the side 1, or part of first part of side 1. The interview was done July 23rd, 1977. We'll pick right up where tape number 6 left off.
I don't think we should have searched. That's what one time north. I spoke northeast of the aisle. I have not changed my first estimate of the situation and will always feel that she went down north and west of Holland Island. And within, well, 200 or 300 miles, that I couldn't say.
And I'd say he was being rather conservative, so he wouldn't have egg on his face.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that far.
But with all the hindsight of 40 years, would you care to take a, if you had to write down a figure you had to live with, what could you live with?
Oh, I'd say maybe nature of 50-75. I'm just only a guess. But on the other hand, I also agree that apparently there was some criticism that they didn't do enough searching. The attitude on the ship was that they were doing something useless and didn't give their all, but that's entirely wrong. I just get the by implication. But, that's about all I have.
Well, I'm going up to Alaska. My wife and I are taking a vacation. And I'm going to be in Juneau, and all of the records are kept in Juneau, and
yeah,
I hope to be able to find records of... But vaguely, close as you can remember, he was walking down the street one day, and he alone...
It was one night.
One night.
Yeah, and had a heart attack. But I want to say it was Ketchikan, because at that time, as a matter of fact, I almost certain it was Ketchikan, that we did not have a district in Juneau. So the 13th Coast Guard District in Seattle had a subsection or division. That headquarters was in Ketchikan, but that... Then we didn't have a full district. Now we have a regular district up in Juneau.
It would be like the Hawaiian section was.
Right, exactly the same. Or in one time, around 36 and 37, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Pedro, Long Beach were only divisions of the 12th Coast Guard District. That's why we were sending all our messages to the 12th. There was no such thing as the 11th Coast Guard District, which we now have.
Can you think about what time this might have been? What month, what year?
What was that?
That Thompson died. I'm going to have to go through a lot of newspapers, and if I can find out what year it was, well, it'll save me a lot of...
I haven't the faintest idea.
Cigarettes?
Yeah, cigarettes.
I'm just about ready.
But the rumor that you heard about Cipriani, that he was torpedoed when he was serving in the Merchant Marine.
That's only a rumor.
That's the only rumor.
I've heard this from other enlisted men who've been shipmates with him. Matter of fact,
you know anybody that might give us a clue, that might know where anything about him?
The only one that might know anything about him is Anthony, and I doubt if Anthony knows anything.
No, he doesn't know anything about him.
The main reason that Anthony does, while he was in the Coast Guard, he worked mostly for the Navy. He was one of the early radio operators that got interested in copying Japanese radio messages. So when things were getting kind of hot, they turned him over to Navy intelligence, and they had some radio interception post out there where he did nothing but copy Japanese, breaking our codes, I guess. But, so, well, He was with the Coast Guard. He didn't do too much work for the Coast Guard. Not that he didn't do work. Then I went to communication headquarters in 43 for about 6 months. And by that time, he was working for the Navy in Washington, some code outfit over there. About, an average of maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, they'd come through the communication department, a citation for honorable mention work for Commander Anthony, who'd done in connection with the, I've forgotten how it was worded, cryptographic work on such and such a date. Nobody in Coast Guard knew what he was doing over there. He was getting all these letters of commendation and things.
Can you think of anything else for
you? Yeah, I had something before that came up, and I've forgotten it again.
Postcard from the other day. He's out
Fajero. Yeah, Fajero. He's after it on a different aspect. And I'm after the airplane. He's out after what happened to Amelia. I don't know what happened to her, but we find the airplane, maybe we'll solve what happened to her. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the airplane never got to Majuro, that's for sure. The airplane.
Nor Saipan.
No,
well, I couldn't quite agree with his thesis that she was a Navy spy. Maybe
we
she was.
No,
if she was, she was the worst one we ever had.
That's what I was going to say. Although sometimes they're the best ones. The ones are clumsy. We got to watch out
she
for them.
She knew Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But we could find absolutely no
Well, evidence. I never could find out what it was she was supposed to spy on. If
yeah.
if she was on some sort of a spy mission, it was the worst planned one in the history of the
doing.
World.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was it she was supposed to spy on?
I never did come up with a book.
Because there was no moon, and we didn't have infrared cameras, and it was an all-night flight if she was flying over the Marshalls.
She wasn't a very good photographer by the pictures.
Well,
that she
there was
took
never
on
any
trip.
Cameras or anything, I don't know. So I have a complete inventory of the airplane. When she cracked up in, well, that was from the first flight, when she cracked up in Honolulu there, why this young Army lieutenant who was made responsible for the airplane, he inventoried it, and I found a copy of his inventory in the National Archives.
Oh, I thought Dan Cooper had been responsible for it.
On the first and second flight, but Dan was down in the Shoshone, and then he was with you on the Itasca.
I was thinking about...
No, when she cracked up at Luke Field. There was an Army Air Corps lieutenant who was given responsibility for everything in the airplane, prepared for shipment. And luckily, he inventoried everything. So that gave me an inventory, including serial numbers and everything. Everything that was in the airplane. This is why I know what books they were using. He inventoried all the books she had and everything, which really helped because it gave me an inventory of everything that was in the airplane.
I don't know if you'd ever seen him. Wonder if Amelia Earhart's still alive.
Oh,
that was so outrageous, I couldn't even finish
you
it.
You see the TV film they did called In Search of Amelia Earhart?
No.
They showed Gerner.
Joe Gervis.
And Joe Gervis and Elgin, and they talked about the three different theories of what's happened to him.
There was another fellow who wrote a book. He lives up in Chatham, New Jersey.
Dick Striple?
Yeah. I'm sure he's seen all of them.
Oh, that's all right. Does he have any albums or pictures or whatnot from those days?
I don't know. His mother used to keep a scrapbook, and I was thinking maybe.
In Dick Striple's book here, Amelia Earhart, The Myth and the Reality, he's given a copy to Captain Sutter, and he says, Captain Sutter, without your help, this would have been a far less meaningful effort. Thanks a lot, Dick Striple. That's nice. Yes,
Gilbert Island. Amelia Earhart. And we thought we had clearance. The Navy Task Force commander said, go over to Allen's and question the native. Then we could take turns going ashore. We talked to the native and tried to give him a concept. He spoke in English what an airplane was. We tried to sound like an airplane. We'd go like this, and they'd say, oh, the birds are over there. We finally went down to the commissioner in Tarawa. He was a little put out that we hadn't cleared our visit through him. We thought he was maybe amazed. Oh, later he turned out to be all right. But, he said, I want to say he called a tin can telegraph. I don't think that's exactly right. I'll put the message out on the tin can telegraph to find out. So in about 3 or 4 hours, the message came back. No one had ever seen her fly over. Of course, she was over there at night, I guess.
They had ways of communicating between the islands.
Yeah, they did.
Do you remember the difference between wigwag and semaphore?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the wigwag was one flag, and right was a dot, I think, and left was a dash.
And you actually used Morse code.
Morse code, right. And semaphore was two hands. This is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I think.
The ship evidently used wigwag to communicate with the Hawaiian boys.
Oh, they did?
Because the Jimmy Kamakaibi wrote a copyrighted story after that, and he said the wigwag man said so-and-so.
Oh.
And so I take it that they were using it. Though I have pictures of Jim and Tom McKee with semaphore flags, both flags, rather than one flag. So I just wonder whether they mixed up the term semaphore and wigwag or what. But there, I do remember there was a wigwag and there was a semaphore.
Yeah, it's all Morse code. In those days, we used to have drills once a week and wigwag and also semaphore. They've done away with that most part.
Well, I can't think of anything else. I can't. Whatever that thing I wanted to ask him, it was about something to do with personalities rather than, you know, it wasn't anything technical. I can't remember what the heck it was. Well, as far as you know, Leo Bellars or any of the other radio men never indicated to you that if they did know that something was wrong with any transmitters, they never let it get as far as a communications officer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is the quartermaster?
Yeah, Frank Stewart, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know if he's still alive?
That I wouldn't know, no.
I've got a lead on him that he may be down in the San Diego area, so I guess I'll get a hold
of
him.
Well, at one time, I think he ran a Kodak store down there part-time in San Diego, years ago, before the war.
I've heard he's, some of the guys said...
I think he retired, and then they called him back to active duty, and I think he came out as a lieutenant and lieutenant commander.
Because he helped you on the surveys, I know, and
mm-hmm.
and
very
also
capable.
Worked the bridge pretty heavy, being chief mm-hmm. quartermaster.
Well, of course, I never felt the Larch was the best chief radio man. And another one on there, Jesse Stewart. We had two stewards, there was Frank and Jesse. He was really a crackerjack chief radio man. Peg.
They were married just before that cruise, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And I think they were married down in Hilo, or they
no,
went to
Hilo.
No,
they were married in Honolulu. They went to Hilo on their honeymoon.
On their honeymoon.
Right. I think they stayed either at the Volcano House or the military rest camp up there, Kilauea.
And then soon after that, you went on this cruise. She was from a Honolulu or from a Hawaiian Honolulu family.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And she's now married to
Ted Fabik.
Ted Fabik. But she used to live in San Clemente with Mellon, did she?
Yeah. Mellon died, a couple of years ago. He died in San Clemente. Or I guess he died in the Navy Hospital in San Diego.
Well, they're in San Clemente. That sort of ties in to what we heard recently about they not being too well. They may have come to the coast for hospitalization or medical treatment. You know, they may have had some of her records there in the San Diego area.
You don't have any old albums or pictures or...
I have some, but I'll have to take a little time to find them.
Wait a minute now. Where do you think you're going to look?
Thinking there.
Well, I don't think so.
Huh?
I don't think so, honey.
August 17th.
August 17th. You're a Leo.
Leo, right.
He's August 12th. That's how he knows.
Oh.
Otherwise, I wouldn't know.
Dark.
And they sailed in a longboat 1,200 miles to Samoa. Hmm. The captain's wife and the crew.
Well, that's Miller there. Okay. On the cruise, Peggy Mellons, who was recently married to Ensign Mellon, her maiden name was Walsh.
Walsh.
And the Walshes who were on board were her father and or younger brothers.
Both younger brothers.
Okay.
Well,
see? They made the whole trip worthwhile. I tried to run all these people down to find out who they were.
I remember one brother went over and killed a goonie bird and ate it raw. And boy, he was a sick kid for about 3 or 4 days.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. All right. Well, that explains that. There was one other guy on board. Had a real funny name. I mean, not funny name, but a real odd name. Your memory's better than anyone's.
No, it really is. No.
It
remember,
is.
Because he had memory.
Most
excellent. Things,
it's
excellent. What the heck was this other guy's name? Never have been able to figure out who he was. He was a guest of the wardroom, but I don't know whose guest he was. But his name was... Oh, boy. Kind of zip, zap, zip. Oh, I mean, I want to copy a couple pictures. This is a copy lens, if I may.
Oh, excuse me.
What I was thinking is, see what happened. He had 3-inch,
1.1.
This for me?
6-pounder. So when they started making their pass there, we opened
doll.
Up the blanks and they were really surprised.
And they took such good care of some of them.
Sure,
you know,
so they this Major Driscoll, including Cooper, being one of the pilots.
No, Bissell, Major Bissell was aboard. We were taking him on a junket. But Kenner and he had fixed this stuff before.
And Kenner being the practical joker, probably be a good idea if they made a mock attack on the ship.
Yeah.
But he double crossed everybody.
Yeah, didn't tell them that they were going to fire blanks.
And when they saw all the smoke coming back from the ship, they didn't press on the attack.
Oh, they did. I guess they were pretty surprised, according to Cooper later.
Retired FBI.
Well, they didn't think much of you as gunners if you pressed on the attack.
It gives you an idea.
A lot of stories told about Frank Kenner. He was
a tremendous guy.
Oh, yeah.
His brother tells one.
This was another passenger.
He was, his brother went, you know, followed him into Manila as captain of the port after the
war. I knew he was out there. He was out there when I was out there.
Well, Frank had it first, and Bill followed him right in. Bill went back about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago.
The other side of the passenger.
He got the cab.
Library.
The guy was obviously in a
library.
Mm-hmm. They asked him what he was doing. He said, I used to be in the Coast Guard. And I met
a
little Filipino girl.
You
have family.
Uh-huh.
I live here now.
Ceremony.
He said, oh, you're in the Coast Guard? And when was that?
We
was driving World War II. This was the port district
here.
Oh, do you remember anyone named Kenner? Oh, sure. He was my commanding officer. There's two of them. Twin brothers, you know. One was a son of a bitch. The other was a nice guy. I was afraid to ask which one was which.
Oh, he was one of the best commanding officers ever.
Which
served.
Ship was that?
See, he was in command for a long time. He had one.
This is too dark.
The captain was aboard. He got transferred to Washington.
But
a new captain had to come from someplace in Alaska, Sitka. And he was a long time getting there. And then he was aboard about 2 months, and he was sent to hospital Pearl Harbor. He was eventually retired. So all his time, Kenner
is
the commander.
Village, Arica.
I served with him several times.
Arica, Chile.
You served what?
With Frank several times. He was operations officer in Coast Guard headquarters when I was stationed there.
Oh, this is Bill here, sitting by the...
You know, Bill was always suspicious that Frank didn't die of a heart attack.
I don't know if I have any pictures.
Oh, is that right?
He was always suspicious. He'd been having some trouble with some...
He wanted me to throw that out, but I didn't.
Bugs.
You know, I don't like to part with them, no matter how fun they are. This is the chief engineer.
Gardeners, his greenhouse sort of thing. I guess he was raising orchids and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd used some exotic
chemical
the day... day before he died or something like
here's
that.
Here's our Christmas party.
And
the chief engineer
the autopsy was inconclusive as far as...
See, everybody's having a good time.
He was never convinced that Bill hadn't fallen, had a reaction to some sort of poison that really did him in.
Remember, he had built a tremendous house out in, out near Diamond Point.
This is an excellent picture of the first
where he's my boss in Washington. So you're going back and living in your house? He said, I can't afford to live in my own house. I have to rent it out. But I could see where he'd have a heart attack. He was always bouncy. We used to notice on officers coming out to Honolulu, even myself. When you first got out, the first 6 months were bouncing around, maybe a year. And after a while, every time you had a chance to sit down, you sat down. So he came aboard, and Sweet Nelson, Navigator, he's dead now. He said, I'll give him 6 months before he slows down. He never did slow down all that.
Sweet Nelson was a good friend of Noonan's, wasn't he?
Of who?
Fred Noonan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he is sweet. A very close friend,
having a beer. And on this one, they had
in fact, it was too sweet that most of you guys met Fred, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
You know, it must have seemed kind of strange and odd to, you know somebody that was involved.
Yeah.
You know, Amelia was something in the newspapers, but to really know somebody involved there,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me like you could have almost transferred your real apprehension to Fred rather than to Amelia.
You say to wait a little while yet, huh?
Well, I'd love to look into it.
You remember
we're going to go
that Morgenthau was in Honolulu that came in that morning?
Oh, yeah. He ordered Thompson out there. I don't know. Big go-around.
Now, this is
I don't have to go around. I just
passenger
have to
lounge on the other ship.
That's something.
Yeah, it's nice.
The reason I left is a fellow named Don McKay, later admiral out in the 14th. He's retired, not in Oakland, outside of Oakland.
She's
but he was
600 and how long ago? 60 feet, the Mormon Altair?
Yeah, around 650. But McKay came down, so he had some, I think, no, he wasn't a classmate in Nelson, but several of the officers, even.
And that's okay.
So
I guess that's
he was sitting down to what, drink coffee and beef and say,
"Say
what Morgenthau would say, could I give you New York Times?
No,
get me some
big bar
expensive cigars. You never paid the McKay a dime."
So they
only
opened the bar. That's the chief steward.
What you call a gopher.
Yeah, right, a gopher, but an expensive gopher because he was doing all the paying.
Retired
well,
president of
Morgenthau. Donald was there when...
Awfully nice guy. And this fellow is a coffee broker from Buenos Aires.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife got off in Buenos Aires.
Thompson.
So that's another reason.
And
that
the thing he remembers most about it was Thompson.
Sandra came back.
She was
and
loud and clear,
working on
and, but her voice was very emotional and
this
choked towards
wife.
The end.
Nice
which I believe it was. Tension was setting in.
I have
like
that. Oh,
no, that's not on deck.
That'd
be the same way by itself.
Better believe it.
And this is the other fascinating.
Talking about Thompson's drinking. He got in Honolulu. He'd been to
the
party night before. He had an awful hangover.
Picture of Nick and the first mate. Yeah,
and I had to watch. And he used to have come up the gang and go back and go in a special hatch down to the cabin.
Captain's cabin.
You didn't have to go. You could go through the water room, but you had his own.
That's another very good one.
So
that's what I ought to look into.
That time they had a 14th Coast Guard district.
Yes.
The fellow named Toll was in command. But everybody in the district wore white.
Now these are too light, but this is
so I knew the old man had a hangover.
Our stateroom was like 20 by 20.
This guy in a old wrinkled linen suit and a straw hat come aboard and
I had
he said, good morning, anything
I
can do for you? He didn't ask me anything.
Oh, no.
He has a right for the captain. He said, wait a minute, Buster, where are you going?
There's another.
What are you, who are you talking to? He said, I'm talking to you. You're not supposed to go down there without my permission.
This is the chief engineer.
He said,
oh, he was a
I don't need your permission.
Person.
I'm Captain Toll, district commander.
Yes, sir. You're right, sir.
Well,
permission granted, anyway, sir.
Yeah.
Argentine beef.
Really?
Well, you are.
Now, that was the end of side one, tape number four, and of the W.L. Sutter interview. We'll now turn it over to side two of tape number four and continue on from there. Well, there was very little on side two of tape number four, W.L. Sutter interview, and so that was the end, practically, of the interview on side one, just a minute or two on side two, nothing particular on it. So that will that concludes the tapes on Captain William L. Sutter, United States Coast Guard, retired, who was communications officer on the Itasca, June and July 1937, during Amelia Earhart disappearance. Just a few remarks on the interviews that were held with Captain Sutter. Though the two interviews were held almost 2 years apart, essentially, I felt that Captain Sutter told basically the same story, and the hazy parts of his memory that were hazy in 1975 were approximately the same ones that were hazy in 1977. The misconceptions that he had were approximately the same. My personal feeling was that Captain Sutter's was honestly trying to remember the events as well as he could, but the fixation that Lieutenant Cooper was in the room at the last must be an error, because Lieutenant Cooper's report shows that he was on the island during that period of time, and Captain Sutter acquiesced that perhaps it wasn't Lieutenant Cooper who was in the room. Things like that. I think that his memory was just hazy on certain things. There was two or three things he stated that I thought were of interest. One was that he wrote the original transcript of the radio communications that the Itasca presented at the end of the cruise, and that he turned over to Commander Baker, the executive officer, who made some changes and turned it over, who in turn turned it over to Commander Thompson, Captain Thompson of the Itasca, and he made some changes, and that the things that were in the report that were taking various people to task were not of his origin. As an ensign, a junior ensign, he hadn't dared put anything like that in the report. Those comments and whatnot were more Mr. Baker's and Mr. Thompson's. I think that the rest of the thing is as he remembers it, and I really don't believe that, and I thought it was very important that he thought it, remembered that at the time they thought maybe their transmitter wasn't working, and why she couldn't hear them. However, he would not really know whether the transmitter's working. He would have to take Chief Bellart's or the radio men's word for it, and of course their report would be self-serving, and the only thing that's bad about Leo's report is that other things which were critical, Leo continually denied, even though there's out-and-out proof that they could not transmit voice on anything but 3105. Leo kept insisting that they could, which he very well knew better. It makes it suspect. O'Hare admitted that it was in retrospect that he thought that their transmitter wasn't modulating, but when we get into really digging into the logs, especially the other listening stations, this mysterious carrier could very well have been the Itasca putting out a carrier with intermittent or just sometimes modulating. Anyway, we'll dig into that later. Now, we'll leave Captain Sutter now, and we'll go to Commander Henry M. Anthony. Now, Henry Anthony was a warrant officer at Honolulu at the time, and he was assistant communications officer, I believe, at Honolulu. At least he was head of the technicians department there. And he was running the listening station that was set up in the Aloha Tower at Honolulu. And also, there's some evidence that Anthony helped arrange to get the direction finder from the Navy. Also, Mr. Anthony later very much distinguished himself as a cryptologist. He's a fellow who broke the Japanese code and received much acclaim for it. Commander Anthony, this interview, the tape that I'm going to use now, we'll call this Tape 1, Side 1, was done in Oakhurst, California, on July 22, 1975.
Interview with Commander Henry M. Anthony, United States Coast Guard, retired. That's M as in Mary, A-N-T-H-O-N-Y, Anthony. And it lives at P.O. Box 38, Oakhurst, California. Zip is 93644. Phone number is 209-683-4646. And it's Tuesday afternoon, July 22nd, 1975. And we are in the living room of Mr. Anthony's home here in Oakhurst, California. And it's approximately 12:40 in the afternoon. Later on in this tape, you will hear references to the Coast Guard station Honolulu's call sign. Mr. Anthony called me later at my home in San Mateo after my wife and I had driven from Oakhurst back to home. And that evening, he called me about 10:30 in the evening and told me that he remembered the call sign was NMO. That's Nan Mike Oscar. My wife was talking to his wife in the kitchen while I was interviewing him in the living room. And she related that Mr. Ken Moore, who was with him in Honolulu, may still be alive and be living in Florida. She also related that when they went to see and hear Fred Gerner in Fresno, Mr. Gerner, after the conference, was talking to her husband for a few minutes, and her husband asked him a couple questions and made a couple statements, and Fred Gerner told him that he didn't know what he was talking about and refused to talk to him anymore. That's about all I have afterthoughts.
Visitor last year when we were out there.
Your wife said that you took a trip to Honolulu.
Yeah, they had a BFW convention over in Hawaii.
I would say 34, 35, 36 times.
Well, we set up, established the Hawaiian section, San Francisco Division Coast Guard in. November 36.
November 36.
Yeah. And, see, before that, there'd only been a ship there, a cutter. There'd been no district or division or section or anything. So we went out there, and the first CO was Commander Bill Toll. He went out on the same ship.
How do you spell that?
T-O-W-L-E. And, see, there was that shipping strike was on.
That's right.
36.
I remember that. Yeah.
So we went out on the Duane. It was Coast Guard cutter Duane. She was one of the new Treasury class. And we also carried a number of custom inspectors. Is this thing on now?
Yes.
We carried a number of custom inspectors because we were at. Implementing a program of narcotic smuggling, trying to suppress narcotic smuggling. That was one of the basic reasons that they established that Hawaiian section. And he was then Commander Kenner. He was, when we got out there, he was chief of staff, and Toll was section commander. And I was communications, operations, personnel, gunnery, and everything else. And we did have a pay clerk.
Were you a warrant?
Yeah, time? I was a warrant officer.
What, were you a gunner?
No, I was a communications specialist.
Communications
specialist. Yeah. So we brought out also two 400 boats. They were 400 class of small craft.
High speed,
allegedly high speed.
Okay.
They were designed to, during the Pearl fishing days to chase rummies. And we had a couple of small craft that we had taken over in the interim. We also had a boarding cutter. And the Duane was the main big ship. And we had two 125-footers, the Tiger and the Reliance. They were also brought out during Prohibition.
The Duane relieved the Itasca then?
Yeah, the Itasca had been there before, and then the Duane. The Itasca was transferred to San Diego, oh God, probably mid-36. And the Duane was sent out there. Then she was relieved by the Taney, which was another Treasury class cutter, and the Taney became the big cutter in Honolulu.
Yeah, the Duane was only there for about 3 months, I think.
No, well, she wasn't even there that long, about a month and a half.
I see. So she, the Duane had a large boom and had the capability of carrying quite a bit of deck cargo or something, didn't she?
Yeah, they designed us that class with a boom. They were supposed to carry a float plane. We had the old, how stupid can I get? J2F.
Yeah.
The old single-engined...
biplane.
Yeah.
Single float.
Yeah. They were originally designed to carry them on the quarter deck when this big boom, well, it didn't work. They, because like the cruisers and the battle wagons used to carry the SOCs,
but
we put the damn thing in the water out to Pearl and hell, you couldn't even hoist it aboard, so we based the plane out to Ford Island. It never worked. They never were practical. Kind of picked that damn thing up.
The as a matter of fact, the Shoshone.
Shoshone. Yeah.
Didn't even have that boom on it.
No. That was the only ones that come out was the Treasury class.
I see.
And then they took the damn thing off. There was.
Yeah, and I think the Taney even had its removal.
Yeah, they took them off all of those.
See, great idea, but it didn't work.
Christ. They tried. I was in the damn thing. I was not a flyer, but I used to do a lot of flying. I always took the radio operators.
Well, now, where was your station? Were you...
Our headquarters first were in the old naval station on Ala Moana in Honolulu, right opposite Pier 4. Then finally we got... took over two decks up in the Aloha Tower. And that was our office and also radio station. We had 6 and 7 decks, 7 or 8, I forget which, in the lower tower.
But that would have been later on in about...
That was beginning into 37.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember your call sign that you set up there?
God. I should, but I've forgotten it.
It turns out it was NMO.
Wailupi.
No, we didn't move to Wailupi until after the war started.
I see. So
that
was Navy. And the Navy was handling the Coast Guard communications for the Line Islands up until the time you got your station established in the lower tower.
Yeah.
I see. That must have been a little later in 37 before you actually got on the air.
No, we were on the air in 36, in December 36.
Or you were.
Yeah. Then in 37 I got more equipment, more transmitters, more receivers, and then I got radio men. We run 24-hour watch.
In 36, you think?
The end of 36 and end of 37. About we were full bore in January of 37.
I have no idea what your call sign was. Because KSF, you know, was setting their south side.
Oh, I know KSF, but... God, it's funny, I can't remember that.
Well, that's right, maybe it'll come to
It's odd. I can remember destroyers. I was on the submarines and... on the East Coast. It's funny, I can't... What the hell was that damn call?
Was it a three-letter station, a short call?
Yeah, three-letter. What the hell was it? No, damn, it was a four-letter call.
You were using it, you were considered to be a portable, or you considered to be a ship rather than a...
It's funny, that's odd.
Okay.
That question, that's the first time it's ever come up. I should remember it, but I don't.
Now, so you actually just used the Duane for transportation. You weren't ever attached to the Duane?
No. I was on shore duty.
And
your job was to start setting up communication for this.
We established the communication set up in for the Hawaiian section.
And when did you start getting some radio men in to help you do all this work?
Well, I brought one radio man with me when we came over on the Duane.
You remember his name, I can't? Was he a third, second?
No, he was first class. I had all first class. Oh, it was Moore, J.P. Moore.
J.P. Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
Yeah.
Maybe I can look him up.
He did.
Oh, he did? Okay. Thank you. You just saved me a lot of trouble.
Yeah, he did.
And, go ahead. I don't know what to ask you, because I really haven't got the picture where you fit in yet.
Well, they say we set up this communication setup in the lower tower on the 7th deck, and we handle all communications with the cutter, with our plane, with our small craft, and with our 125-footer. Normal operation, because we then started trailing the Japanese merchantmen coming in from the Orient. We would pick them up off Kauai, about 90 miles west of Kauai, and our cutters would trail them in right into Honolulu. When they arrived in Honolulu, then we would board. I always led the boarding party. I'd board off port. And we boarded every merchant ship that came from the Orient entering Honolulu.
So no fishermen or anybody could get something over the side from them?
Well, before we came over there to establish the section, these ships from the Orient would throw over after they passed Kauai, coming towards Honolulu. They would throw over a load of narcotics and buoy it, and then the sampan small craft would pick it up. That was one of the basic reasons we started the Hawaiian section. The first CO originally, I said Toll, but he was, Parker was out there. He was then Commander Stanley V. Parker. And then we relieved him, Toll relieved him. At the time Parker was there, it wasn't a section. He was just a senior SOP. But there was no section at the time.
That's S-T-A-N-L-E-Y.
Yeah,
B as in boy, Parker, P-A-R-K.
No, B for Victor.
B as in Victor.
Yes, and he was the commander then, and he was ordered back to San Francisco, and he made four strikes.
That's pretty heavy stuff in 36, isn't it?
Yeah.
You had, in 1936, actually I believe it was March, I so many things in my head, I'm not quite positive, but they sent out with the Hawaiians who were colonizing the Harlem, Baker, Jarvis, later Annenberg, and Canton, some Chinese radio operators with them.
They were all Hawaiian boys. Some were Chinese, some Hawaiians, mixture, that's a mixture as you well know out there. They had four to each island. And that was the original attempt for a while, and then sometimes they cut it back, maybe three, two. They'd go down every quarter and relieve. The cutter would go down and relieve.
Did you supplies. Ever make any of those cruises?
No, I never went down.
Well, now, in your station at Aloha Tower, did you communicate at all with the Line Islands? Did you pick up
no,
any of their weather?
No, we normally never worked them because they had a station in Honolulu with one of the Hawaiian boys that maybe he'd make the trip before and then he would work them every night.
He'd man the station.
Yeah.
Amateur
preaching. Yeah,
that's
right. We're all amateurs, yeah. So we never worked them. We'd monitor them sometimes, but they had established schedules every night, so that had been, see, when they first started in 35. That's when the Itasca first went down the islands in 35, when they were saying taking over there when the British wanted the islands.
It's a beautiful story, and it's never been properly told.
No, unfortunately, I never kept notes in those days. I have to pull this out of my head.
Well, at that time, there was a lot of things happening. as you probably knew, Pan American and some of the British airlines were wanting to establish service between Honolulu and New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Pan American made the first run.
Right, that was...
Well, they used to go to Pan American. He used to go into Canton until Pan American had a station, a radio station.
Because that service started about 37 or 8,
mm-hmm.
or 38 or 39, right? Survey flight was in 37.
I knew that captain too. He was lost.
Captain Music?
Yeah, Music. I knew all that Pan American crowd. Well, they worked closely. That's when they used to land with the Sikorskys out there in Westlock.
And where?
In Westlock, Pearl.
Oh, at Pearl, Westlock?
Yeah, that's when they were running, just flying the boat.
Did you ever work a guard station for them, or were they working their own Pan Am at their own station?
Their radio station in Honolulu was out of Makapu.
At Makapu? Makapu?
No, Makapu. See, the Makapu or Makapu. Yeah.
That's out over at Kaneohe.
Yeah, Kaneohe, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, we'll turn over to side two, review of communication.